Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight-loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight-loss. PlushCare.com/weight-loss.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to this week's New Statesman podcast.
We talk about the European elections.
And who should be the next Tory leader, who shouldn't be the next Tory leader, and who nonetheless will be the next Tory leader. Stephen, you were manning the New Statesman live blog, the thriller that it was, which actually you unexpectedly got to close early, right? So does that mean that the results were more interesting than we thought they might be, or less interesting?
It's just that they were quicker than we expected them to be, which I realised I actually still don't fully understand why that was the case.
Just London just really sort of got a wiggle on, right, in a way that people were not expecting. And I guess Scotland, because of the hangman, I learned this word, is it Sabbatarianism of the Western Isles? They don't work on Sunday, they're religiously observed. So if it had been really close and those Western Isles votes had made a difference, we wouldn't have got that result until Monday morning for Scotland as a region. Neither of those happened, though.
Well, yeah, so basically none of the things which usually delay it happened. But so it's odd because my assumption at first was, oh, right, it's quicker because they haven't had any local authority results to count. But then I remembered that the results of the Euros are always on a Sunday. So it wasn't that, oh, well, you had to declare something else first. Regardless, it meant that the results had basically, well, my set of results had all come in by around 1 o'clock. So I was able to close the live blog and go to bed at a fairly reasonable time once the industrial qualities of ginger ale I had had to prevent myself from falling asleep had worn off. And then Patrick very ably did Northern Ireland and the kind of official Scotland results when they came in.
Well, let's start with Northern Ireland because that is interesting. So you've got three MEPs, one each from, is it the DUP?
Yes.
Alliance, which is a non-aligned party but a pro-EU party that is a sister party of the Liberal Democrats. And the third MP is...
Sinn Féin, although actually...
Is it Sinn Féin? Okay, that's
so actually the first MEP was the DUP, second was Sinn Féin, and the Alliance got the third.
Which was a fight between the Alliance and some other pro-Brexity unionist parties, right?
Essentially, I mean, so I actually haven't looked at all of how the STV stuff came through, but essentially, in many ways, actually, the Northern Ireland result is very similar to the story of the results across the United Kingdom and indeed the kind of political problem of Brexit as a whole, which is that there is a decent-sized chunk of people who are willing to vote on Remain Leave lines, and there is enough of them that it is quite difficult to win a majority on traditional lines, whether that be left-right or constitutional lines. However, there are too few people to vote along Remain Leave lines for that to be a viable alternative path to a majority either.
I was really excited that was not the Star Wars Cantina theme tune. Have you got all your different theme, like different ringtones for different people?
I have basically two ringtones. Uh-huh. I have a set of ringtones for everyone who's not my partner, and then I have a set of ringtones for my partner so I can, you know, triage.
I mean, that makes sense. So that's the thing I think was interesting. You said this in the live blog, was that we were halfway between... If you talk about the realignment of British politics, it hasn't got there yet, right? We're stuck awkwardly between the two, if you are going to say that whether or not people are voting Labour Tory, unionist or whatever, versus Remain Leave, that actually it's just deadlocked completely because the old order is dying, the new one is struggling to be born.
Well, yeah, indeed. And so, I mean, one of the kind of the takes that... I mean, there are lots of takes coming out of the European election, and I think... are either trying too hard or not trying enough. But yeah, the one which is though, this shows that at the next election, yeah, you're going to have to be the party of Remain or the party of Leave.
Yeah, I don't ever buy that one because
it's a Well, the problem is it's demonstrably untrue.
If you're Labour and you go full bore second referendum, great, you might pick up some more seats in places or strengthen your hold on seats you already have or stop you losing seats to the Lib Dems. But you are also sacrificing like Ashfield or wherever it might be or Bishop Auckland.
Yeah.
But yeah, so but that's the problem, isn't it? It's not like, wow, there's just an easy thing that like, add this and you just take a huge number of percentage points on and you don't and there's no downside to it at all.
Yeah, and because ultimately almost everywhere has a large enough supply of Remain voters or Leave voters for them to be damaging to you on the first past the post. I mean, so to take, say, you know, the kind of thing that people like, oh, you know, Labour has to hold together a coalition which runs from Kensington and Ashfield. Well, in Kensington, they won by, I want to say, 71 votes.
Yeah, and it was, I want to say 47, but yeah, it was under 100,
but,
right?
There are more than 100 people who will both, in Kensington, who will both have voted to leave the EU and will have voted for Labour in 2017. In Ashfield, which they again held by a three-figure sum, there are more than 1,000 people who will have voted for the Labour Party in Ashfield in 2017 who voted to stay in the EU. So there is no clean transition, and I think one of the really fascinating subplot of this referendum is every indication isn't the Conservative core vote, you know, in their hilarious fifth place finish, had about the same number of Remainers as it did Leavers. Now, bluntly, if you are a Remainer at this point voting for the Conservative Party,
you deserve everything you get.
Well, no, I just think that those people are clearly not going. Yeah, that I think alone discredits this idea that a party of Remain can form a viable governing. And not least because the problem that all political, well, that both political parties / all political parties are going to have to grapple with is that the one success, in heavy inverted commas, of Theresa May is that mostly the way that referendums can make governing quite difficult afterwards is the losing side does blame you, but the winning side doesn't thank you.
Yeah, I mean, Theresa May, not a woman who looks very thanked right now. So that, I think
but
that does
hold
up.
She has at least managed. So
she has brought the country together in thinking that she was terrible at being Prime Minister.
This thing is, being an angry leaver is still a political identity, which there are a number of things that she could have done that would probably have meant that it was not a political identity 3 years on. But yeah, so let's imagine for a moment that the Labour Party goes into a snap election in autumn or late summer of this year on a second referendum position, and it can cobble together, thanks to that, a majority with the aid of the other smaller pro-Remain parties. Let's say that referendum is then won by Remain.
Big if, yeah.
Right, but these are all fairly large ifs, right? Because, I mean, this thing, it's all of the polling suggesting that Labour would win on the second referendum requires you to believe that 20% of people would be sufficiently angry about Brexit not happening that they would vote for the Brexit Party, knowing full well that, thanks to first past the post, this would not result in them electing a Brexit MP, but would result in a government that would stop Brexit led by Jeremy Corbyn.
This was the kind of theme that ran through your live blog, wasn't it? Is that actually the squeeze message at the general election is so potent of like, vote for us or the other side will get in of the big two, that it's so tempting but should be resisted to overinterpret from these results. And the other thing I thought was really interesting was saying, to what extent is the Brexit Party just UKIP 2.0, right? Then, and actually that really should affect how we treat it. Because I was going through their list of candidates and it's really, I mean, I think you put this in your piece last week. It's really obvious how much of their infrastructure comes from UKIP, how many of their candidates are former UKIP supporters or even people who've run for Parliament before, you know, or actually are from kind of what I would describe as Nigel Farage's inner circle, right, of just people that he's very closely bound to. And that does kind of affect it. But how significant is them winning what's 31.7% of the vote? Like, actually, does that change British politics? Or is this just purely, I'm going to have a bit of a free kick, a party that says Brexit on it, I don't care, they haven't got a manifesto, I don't care about any of that?
Well, I mean, it's probably a combination of all three. So the thing that deserves and needs further study is, it's not clear. Now, obviously, from an organisational perspective, it's UKIP. It's why in the live blog I was going, well, this is a UKIP game, this is a UKIP hold. Because ultimately, if a party has the same...
Well, if Alexandra Phillips wins a seat in the South East after having previously been UKIP's head of press, yeah, right? It's not exactly like... For a party led by Nigel Farage, who is the most recognisable UKIP politician ever, then that doesn't feel like a not a UKIP victory.
Yeah, and in terms of the people who he trusts who are have their hands on the levers of that party, ultimately he met them all via UKIP, right? The things they have learned to do well, and the kind of ways that they keep the subtext, are things they learned at UKIP, right? So it's...
Talking about that, there was an amazing moment, I'm going to say, from Richard Tice on the BBC, when he was a bit annoyed because Alistair Campbell had riled him up and said something like, oh, you bet you took a few rubles during the campaign, and then he got all kind of like, we didn't take any Russian money, blah, blah, blah. And Alistair Campbell went, I think, why can't you take a joke? Which obviously wound him up even further. And he said this very telling phrase, which was something like, Labour needs to ask why it's losing in its heartlands, and it's the party of now Islington elites. And I was like, oh, look at that. There's a little dog whistle there for somebody. Because there is no analysis that you can look at that says Islington is not a Labour heartland, right? I think actually it's in your piece this week is that they've been winning Islington for donkey's years.
I mean, there are many things about Brexit discourse which wind me up. And then, indeed, there are many things to continue my, oh God, it is now becoming a weekly tradition of Stephen complains about a group of Labour MPs who refuse to vote for the deal, refuse to vote to stop Brexit, and just sit there writing pained articles in Redbox about how it's all very complex. Ultimately, if your definition of Labour heartland includes places which voted Conservative in 1983 and 1987, and excludes places which have voted for the Labour Party quite literally since Keir Hardie was,
right,
alive.
Then just say white.
Just say white. It's just like, no, you'll feel better and the rest of us will actually... I have a lot more time for, the fact that, like, Gloria DiPiero goes, we have a problem holding together both halves of our coalition, including, small town, etc. So she doesn't act like Hackney is somehow an illegitimate part of the
This is what really annoys me, and I think political journalism indulges it. I've been writing this lecture, which I'm giving in Oxford this week, about the failures of political journalism, and one of them is that perception that there is a kind of Volk, right? And there are some people who are much more legitimately British than others. And if we're going to say, oh, we hate identity politics, which people do all the time, particularly on the right, then you cannot expect to hold up. Citizenship is an identity that everyone merits equally once they've got a British passport, right? So you cannot say that a second generation Nigerian British person who works as a nurse in London is somehow not as British as someone upset about fishing in Grimsby. Like, that shouldn't be an argument that you can make. And yet, it's so... And I don't think it's an argument anyone would any longer make out loud, but the framing of those, we go vops popping in this community, right, just so implicitly like, oh no, it'd be terrible to lose these people because these are real British people. These people are less,
Well, yeah, it's like the framing of so much of it, from the broadcasters, when I was doing sort of post-lecture, it's like, Labour is at risk of losing its northern heartlands. It's just like, well, okay, maybe that's the case. However, just as there are good reasons to suppose that the Liberal surge in the Euros will not last past a Euro, there are good reasons to believe the Brexit Party one won't necessarily either. However, right, Islington is also a Labour heartland. Mm. Camden is also a Labour heartland, right? It is entirely legitimate. I think it's not sensible, for reasons we should get onto. It's entirely legitimate to look at those results and go, we have a problem in our heartland, and we're going to go for the one which the majority of our voters are aligned with, which is Remain, and we're going to go for a second referendum. If you're going to try and pivot to either side of the Brexit poll and you're the Labour Party, you probably are better off pivoting towards the one that 2/3 of your vote backed.
The majority of your members backed, the trade unions backed. Yeah, yeah.
Then you are pivoting to the one...
To Kate Hoey. The pivot minority, to Hoey.
I think, in some ways, like, the reason why these elections are sort of pointless to kind of go, what does this tell us, is ultimately, if you look at the Conservative performance, you go, okay, well, that is a party that is heading towards extinction. If you look at the Labour result, you go, well, that's not a party which is going to win general election anytime soon. Okay, ultimately, though, first past the post means those two takes cannot both be true, which kind of suggests that, in some ways, the more useful question, and the thing which would worry me in both of their shoes, is given we know at a general election that magical button of X can't
vote for
win
us,
here,
you'll get the Tories. Yeah.
Well, which group of voters do I think that is a more plausible message for? Now, from kind of in descending order of plausibility, ultimately there is a reason why Nigel Farage is such a long time advocate for electoral reform. In that argument is much more lethal for them, because thus far, and this is why I think Peterborough is something which, you know, if I were...
So this is the by-election coming up in June?
On the 6th of June, they won all the wards of the borough council as a whole. The borough council and the constituency do not share exactly identical boroughs. There are bits of Peterborough borough council that are not in Peterborough constituency. However, they did well enough that you would assume that they would probably be able to win it in the by-election.
And that was whose seat?
Fiona Ollis.
Who took the dodgy speeding points. So Labour MP.
It's the perfect storm, partly because this is the fun thing about the recall process, and I don't think it's sufficiently understood.
Go on.
When it happens, the local council sends a letter round explaining why the recall has happened, which essentially means...
It's like a free election leaflet for your opponents, basically. Yeah, there going, is we done a bad thing, there, yeah, sorry about that.
Essentially a bit going, by the way, you might have to vote again because your MP has done X. We would expect the governing party, even... Yeah, if we knew nothing about British politics, we would go, oh, the governing party will lose because it's a by-election, right? And then, of course, there are loads of other reasons why we would expect the Conservative Party in their present position to do very badly.
But is Peterborough quite Brexity?
Peterborough is quite Brexity.
I mean, in 2016, not just having voted for the Brexit Party now, yeah.
So we would expect the Brexit... Yeah, we would expect for the governing party to struggle. We would expect it to be quite difficult for the Labour Party to style out its previous MP. I mean, even though, like, you know, it's one of those things where I do genuinely feel quite sorry for the local activists, right, who, yeah, ultimately they didn't select her. The National Party immediately after the court case went, we'd like you to stand down. She hasn't stood down.
She went, nope.
And they're probably going
to... I will never log off, she said.
They're probably going to lose the seat. But the thing is, how consequential are all these things? In a way, not at all. In another way, as we'll of course discuss in part two, hugely, because even though there's loads of reasons to think that the Brexit Party squeeze message of vote for us and vote for Brexit, you don't get Brexit, you get a Labour government, then we'll stop Brexit, will of course be potent for the Conservative Party.
The guess is if it's a sort of nine-way bun fight, then actually at that point, do those messages kind of come out? Is it possible to land the kind of it's X can't win here when it's, you know, Labour versus Conservatives versus Brexit Party? It'd be very messy.
This is the big known unknown about when the next election is. If this Parliament goes the full 5 years, which I find hard to imagine, but let's give it house room, right?
Yeah.
Then there will have been several more by-elections. There will have been several council elections. There will have been London elections. There will have been elections to the devolved parliaments in Wales and Scotland.
We've got London next year, Scotland 2021, Wales 2021.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that gives voters a lot of opportunities to go on holiday when the card of don't you want Theresa May out, don't you want Jeremy Corbyn to stay out, cannot be played by the respective parties. And at that point, maybe, you know, going to other parties has become habit formed. I kind of think, at this point, the one advantage to an autumn election from a Conservative perspective and a Labour perspective is, yes, you have the nightmare of having an election when Brexit is not resolved, but you also aren't swimming against a much smaller tide of people going on holiday to other parties. But actually, this is where I think the Liberal Democrats would worry me more in both parties' shoes, because let's say I am the Conservative incumbent in Chelmsford or Cheltenham, or I don't know why I'm going on a Chelt vibe.
Yeah.
So your message to both Brexit and Liberal Democrats is Corbyn plus a Brexit message, right?
Yeah. Vote for us or you'll get Corbyn. Vote for us and Brexit will either not happen or will happen.
Yeah. But this thing is, the button that the Conservative Party is going to be able to and comfortable pressing is, if you don't vote for us, actually you won't get Brexit anyway, and, you know, that's Gary Corbyn. I wouldn't bet the farm, if I were the Conservatives, on merely the button marked Corbyn, when they will almost certainly, not to foreshadow part two too much, have picked a leader who revolts Liberal Democrat inclined voters.
Let's come back to that, because let's who could that leader be, Stephen? It's so exciting. More of that in part two.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now for part two, the slow motion unfolding horror of the Tory leadership race. Okay, I'm going to go through state of the race as it currently is, and you're going to have to tell me who I've forgotten. Boris Johnson, clear favourite according to the YouGov internal polling, followed by Dominic Raab, everyone's favourite slightly defective action man. Rory Stewart, currently last seen tweeting from a park somewhere, and his new tactic of doing a walkabout around the country and inviting people to come and, I don't know, give him ice cream or something. Esther McVeigh, who I just discovered on a great Facebook group called Ladies for Leave, which is almost unparodyable, former DWP secretary and children's TV presenter. The Saj, has the Saj declared?
Yes.
Sajid Javid, Home Secretary. Matt Hancock of the Matt Hancock app.
Yeah, you have got 6 out of 10. Come
this
on.
This is very exciting. There must be another woman, mustn't there?
I'm not giving you clues.
Michael Gove of OBS. Michael Gove. No, okay, no, you can't. Start giving me clues with the other ones, because when you say them, obviously I'll be able to remember. Kit Malthouse of the Malthouse. Yeah. Presumably he at least knows what the Malthouse Compromise is, but literally no one else does.
So you've got two more.
This is tense. Okay, so come on.
One of them, I'm trying to give
a
clue.
Do a mime, come on.
what's a clue, not a clue? One of them is in the cabinet and is a Brexiteer.
Penny Mordaunt?
Nope. and the other one is in the cabinet. I mean, I'm going to say, so one of the ones you've forgotten is going to be deeply embarrassing to our brand that you've forgotten, is all I'm saying.
Tony Blair. Shocking intervention from him, but okay.
Not Tony Blair. It's just more kind of like, you know, in terms of like a recent issues of the New Statesman kind of way.
No, go on, help me.
Jeremy Hunt.
Oh, yes, Jeremy Hunt. Yes. You know. The trouble with Jeremy Hunt is he's just very generic, and I sort of in my mind had him grouped with Matt Hancock.
And Andrea Leadsom is the...
I knew there was another woman, and of course, as a mother, Andrea Leadsom was her. Okay, right. I mean, it could be worse, that field.
I mean, so the thing is, actually, I looked at a picture of them and I just kind of, I'd had a conversation with a very depressed Conservative MP beforehand, and I kind of said out loud in the new politics bullpen, gosh, it's a bad field. And I actually realised it's not really. They actually do have plenty of people who, you know, at least we have to give house room to the idea, could, you know, at the very least stab out a second, you know, kind of, you know, grim hold on power of the kind that they have now.
Yeah, I mean, if you had to rank them in order of your preference, not that obviously you're a 60-year-old Tory member in the Shires, but, you know, there are some that I would definitely rank. I mean, I'm not going to fall in love with any Tory leader particularly, but there are some of them I would definitely put in a different category to some of the others.
Oh, so I realise, I mean, if I were ranking them based on, you know, imagine I am a Conservative MP in a marginal seat, or I am an activist who wants to keep...
So purely not whether or not you think they're good, but whether or not you think they're electorally... potent, which is different things, right? Would you be a good prime minister is one consideration, versus would you, if you go to a snap election in the autumn before it's become obvious whether you are or not, would you be likely to gain seats for the Conservatives? Are two different things. Who do you say is the most electorally potent? Because they think it's Boris Johnson, right?
Yeah, but so they think it's Boris Johnson.
Written about his figures were incredible. Like, was it minus 51 now approval rating in London?
Minus 35 everywhere else.
Which is, used to be plus 50 back when he was mayor, right? Or the start of it, yeah.
I'm going to cheat and do them in reverse order because I feel more confident about the reverse order.
Okay.
Right? Now, Boris Johnson is palpably...
Electoral poison?
The least electorally effective candidate, right? Because everyone else has a really large don't know figure, right? So it kind of comes down to when Change launched as TIG, I said, look, there is really very little point going, oh, what do the polls suggest about how they do? You're much better off eyeballing that group of people and going, how do I think these people will perform under electoral fire when they are given an opportunity to stand before the country?
And what was the answer? The answer was 3.4%?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to intrude on... Is it private grief when it happened in an election? But my point is that actually it turned out that it was a much more useful yardstick for people to go, okay, how do all these people perform, you know, in electoral conditions, than it is to go, oh, what do people who could, in the case of Change, part of their problem is that people still couldn't pick the 11 out of a lineup. But we are talking about a field of candidates who Boris Johnson and Michael Gove aside, people do not know anything about.
And then if you look at the country as a whole, the two of them that are known are widely disliked, right? Michael Gove, having spent that time as education secretary, managed to upset basically all teachers, who are about 500,000 people who are married to often other teachers. But, you know what I mean? He's got actually the people who know him in the country, I think, are probably less likely to be favourable to him than people who are about to meet him.
I also think, so one of the things Conservative MPs will say, and people out in the US will say, oh, you know, Jeremy Hunt and Michael Gove have both got a problem because of doctors and teachers. I just don't think that those problems are remotely comparable, because if you go to the doctors about a bad knee, the doctor doesn't say, you know, this may take a little bit longer because of Matt Hancock. Whereas there is just a more active kind of like, well, thanks to Mr. Gove, we've done this.
We don't get that. Yeah, because he's scrapped Building Schools for the Future. We're all in a shed.
So there's much more of that kind of politicisation and political mobilisation if you upset teachers than there is if you upset... Oh, and I was about to say any, and then I remembered the army and the police. Even the army and the police, right? The army, like, you know, just has to do that thing where it's just like, oh, you know, senior defence sources have told, you know, a paper's defence correspondent, and we could no longer defend
X and
the
y
Falklands
is
or whatever.
Wrong and, yeah.
Right, you know, it's just more politically potent. I actually think the junior doctors thing, I'm not remotely belittling it as a public policy. I'm not saying I think it was a great bit of public policy, but I think that people in the bubble tend to overestimate its potency because they tend to know people who are doctors. I mean, not I just don't. I mean, we can visibly see most people have heard of Michael Gove and do have an opinion of him. Most people have not heard of Jeremy Hunt, and even fewer have heard of Matt Hancock.
Also looks really generic.
So basically, I would say there are two groups. There's Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, who are known quantities, right? Who
polarising, I think, is a nice phrase for them.
Picking them immediately means that the Conservative Party cannot go, I'm new, which is a very big weapon, I would say, to voluntarily divest yourself of when you are a government that has been in power for 9 years, facing a leader of the opposition who has been in power for 3 years and has been to the country once already, right? So one of
this is the John Major theory, isn't it? That actually the 1992 election, it really mattered that they got someone to go, hey, look at our new guy. Like, he left school at 16. You never heard of him. This is not what you think the Conservatives are like, but we are like this.
Yeah.
Which you could plausibly do with, I mean, like a Rory Stewart, you could obviously do it with, but you could do it with one of the Brexity junior Brexit candidates.
Yeah.
Can't really do it with Andrea Leadsom, given she had a go-round last time.
Yeah, but no one knows her. I mean, this thing is, it didn't matter that John Major had been Foreign Secretary, because as far as a lot of voters are concerned, he might as well have been in witness protection.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this is the thing is, Johnson and Gove mean the Tory party foregoes its chance for change. Now, you may have a sufficiently bad opinion from a, you know, from a kind of, you know, in this thing where I'm cosplaying as a Conservative MP in a marginal seat, maybe my view of the other candidates is so bad that I decide that the chance for change is not worth taking. I just don't think that's true. I think it's really so what I think is striking is most people don't know Sajid Javid.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the opinion polls, right, he does slightly better than the generic Tory score, which basically, the people who have heard of him. So the interesting question:
people who have heard of him like him more than the others.
Yeah. So is so the in, this well the interesting question is that because more people like Sajid Javid? Is that because some people really like the idea of voting for the first ethnic minority prime minister? Is that because the people who like him have heard about? I mean, then this is the other question. It's like,
they like the idea of someone who's Home Secretary being PM because they think it's a proper, decent-sized job to have had rather than being a backbencher
and
or whatever.
Is it that they've heard of him saying Windrush could have happened to me, or is it that they've heard of him saying Shamima Begum, who cares about petty things like citizenship and our international obligations?
Yeah.
Or is it that he's in this perfect storm where the groups of voters who've heard those two things like them, and then when you put them together, the whole is less than the sum of its parts? And then you get to the others and you are much more in a kind of eyeball it, in which point, weirdly, despite the fact that occasionally someone quotes a Tory MP saying something cruel anonymously and people go, oh, that is very cruel. But actually, it is perfectly legitimate to look at these candidates who no one knows. And as one Tory MP said to me, I just think then people, when they look at Rob for a while, will start to think he seems mean and evil. And it's just like, you know, that is actually the consideration they
should
apply.
Well, to have your first big interview post in when it's, you know, your hat is sort of officially in the ring with Mar, when having to defend calling feminists obnoxious bigots and saying that life was much, you know, because I think he could have got away with a sort of father's rights agenda. And you'll see that he put in his pledge, one of the things he put in was more paternity leave, which you can kind of present as actually a kind of feminist thing as well as a men's rights thing. But to have to then defend all that, your slightly weird remarks from which you now sort of retcon as being like, oh, I hadn't found the right woman yet, you know, I wouldn't say I was in my wild younger day, who among us has not said these kind of things? I think that's a tough hurdle to trying to overcome. And then the fact that actually he's put out more policy detail, maybe, like the 15p income tax thing seems like a really needless giant policy commitment to put out front and centre that just seems way off the reservation.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So the dynamic of this election is that Conservative MPs are basically saying, well, they're basically saying, we'd really like you not to have an election. We're mostly opposed to a second referendum. But because we're not convinced that you can stick to your promise of a second election, everyone is also going, can you win a general election? Now, I think Raab is essentially now running a candidacy of, I will definitely go for an election, because this parliament is not going to have a 15p income tax. He's just not going to make the decisions on tax and spend that would make
well,
that
Well, no, because you'd have to just abolish whole departments, entirely cut. I mean, how on earth do you even get that much money? Like, you have to raid, like, pensions or something like that. I mean, and a terrible idea that would be. I mean, I just don't think there's money in the welfare budget you could cut.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's nonsense. It is nonsense from soup to nuts. Plus no deal, right? So he becomes the candidate of imminent election, which then is obviously problematic for him. Now, I think...
So your thesis is, if you're going out there promising no deal, lots of Tory MPs will hear that as... you're going in out there promising an election.
Well, in many ways, the Tory leadership election is more like a kind of physics equation than it is, right? So there are two waveforms which could collapse. Waveform one is, right. I, this Conservative MP I'm cosplaying as, believe Boris Johnson to be the election-winning asset he was when he was mayor before the referendum campaign. Now, that waveform might not collapse, right? Because although that is... just statistically, it's a wrong-headed... it's just wrong, right? Just wrong. If you're picking a candidate on electability, pick literally any of the others.
Yeah.
However, people believe it. They've believed it for a while despite it being wrong. There is no evidence that they will not continue believing it till the 23rd of July when Boris Johnson is unveiled as Conservative leader. However, seeing as that waveform could collapse at any point, right? Like, you don't have to think very... there are loads and loads of examples in politics of political parties or countries believing things which are demonstrably untrue. Yeah, I mean, public support for the welfare cuts obviously being the example, up until the first point where someone goes, here's a tangible thing that you claim to support. Are you still into it? Oh God, no, I'm not. So that could collapse. Waveform two is essentially, at the moment, the group of MPs who fear an election while Brexit is resolved are not yet sold on the argument that Jeremy Hunt is trying to make, which is to promise no deal is to trigger an election. And if you have an election when Brexit is unresolved,
Hello,
Prime Minister Corbyn. Now, if either of those waveforms collapse, then that creates a problem for Boris Johnson. And the reason why there are so many candidates, including many who will probably have declared by the time this drops for listeners, the reason why there are so many candidates in kind of the third lane, right? So there's lane one, the establishment, Jeremy Hunt, Sajid Javid, Matt Hancock candidates. There's the, you know, the I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, Esther McVeigh.
Yeah.
And then there are people running essentially in the I have impeccable leave credentials, which means I can do a compromise. I'm going to seek a negotiated Brexit.
Michael Gove.
Yeah, Michael Gove. Had a whole
not
list
so easy,
in my mind.
Is it?
Yeah.
Kit Malthouse. I mean, bless.
So Kit Malthouse is actually running in kind of contest four, which is essentially the like...
I'd like people to have heard of me by the end of this.
Yeah, the awareness running
which
campaign.
Fine, which was the kind of Crab Javid sort of vibe last time, right?
Yeah.
Although, that ended in a sexting scandal. Hey, that's exciting. I wonder who will agree to the Rachel Sylvester interview that will knacker their candidacy, and I wonder who will be caught sexting. Well, that's something to look forward to. If you had to place a bet at this point about who would win?
Boris Johnson. There's this short campaign. I think basically, if we assume that every day there is a 10% chance the waveform collapses.
Yeah, the fewer days there are, the better.
Days, yeah.
The next question is whether or not you think that actually would that split the party? I mean, so Rory Stewart said he wouldn't serve under him. I think there's probably quite a few people in that camp. Are there people who are sufficiently in belief that he is not fit to hold high office that they would actually leave the party?
Well, this is where the weakness of change becomes politically significant. It's because their big argument was, and this actually I think has got a lot of truth to it, was that one of their big arguments was the Liberal Democrats' vitality in the country. Clearly an argument in some doubt. The much more kind of cromulent and still standing argument is that the Lib Dems are not a congenial home for defectors from either party, because if you're the Tories, particularly if you're someone a fairly safe Tory, you've fought them in council elections, they're the enemy, etc., etc. ditto in the Labour Party. But because, yeah, I mean, I spoke to someone in Change who was talking about, we were talking about the future, and they basically said, you know, well, the important thing is they're someone who's very much in favour of, you know, putting their hands up and trying to be more friendly to Lib Dems. And they said, we need to ask ourselves, would you join this party right now? I certainly wouldn't. Mm. And that means then those people will grin and bear it. However, the thing which...
You mean Change, like Change. Other people, yeah, right. Yeah.
The thing which would worry me if I were this Tory MP or Boris Johnson is... The group of MPs who have no prospect of defecting but have no careers left on the front bench or indeed in Tory party politics are at retirement age or are independently wealthy.
Ken Clark,
Philip Hammond, yeah, Dominic Grieve. Yeah. Right, so you only need four potentially to have the crossover. You then obviously need to...
Well, because then that means that even with the DUP, you can't cobble together...
You can't cobble together the confidence vote, and I think...
So if they just went, I'm going to sit as an independent for the rest of this parliament, and then I'm out, oot, the sort of
well,
Frank Field
Or you say,
tactic.
I'll go for the vote of no confidence to prevent you doing a no-deal Brexit.
And say, I'm prepared to bring the government down rather than you do this.
Philip Hammond, yeah, his career is over, and Philip Hammond is not so delusional. There's a reason why Philip Hammond has started doing the kind of like...
He did a proper YOLO Mar interview where he was just like, well, that sounds like a terrible idea, doesn't it? I'm Philip Hammond.
Yeah, and you know, and Philip Hammond does have a small but perfectly formed following in the Conservative Party.
Okay.
And they also happen to be people who are in that same political niche, right? People who'd be sad to be MPs, right? They were ambitious people, but they're also not stupid people. And they know that they have no political future under a Boris Johnson-led Conservative Party. They oppose no deal. And they also are, bluntly, not going to miss their MP's salary. And so I can...
Yeah. If you're going to leave politics, then you might as well leave it in a way that you can tell yourself later that you did it to stop an absolute catastrophe happening to Britain. That is quite a decent way out. Well, we must stop at that point. We will no doubt return to the question of who the next Tory leader is going to be, and indeed what's going on with Brexit, a couple more times before I leave for the Cincinnati Inquirer. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. Why not pick a print copy of the magazine up this week? Because Stephen and I have both written cover stories, Stephen on the fallout from the Euro elections, more exciting digest of that, and I have written, frankly, quite a mean piece about Theresa May.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.